himself enters with a tenor sax fanfare, and Jimmy Garrison opens up with the famous four-note riff. Ba-bum, 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 ba-bum. Jazz critic Ashley Kahn describes this opening as a wake-up call. Coltrane's wife, Alice, rightly saw it as an invitation to journey to a beautiful place. A call from the minaret, the cantor singing the Kol Nidre on Yom Kippur. In philosophy, the idea of the invitation obviously relates to questions of the subject and subjectivity. When I accept an invitation, arguably, I am no longer me. I have become the universal. I am the invitee, the guest. An invitation generously offers us a way of entering into a relationship with the future, but it's a future which is determined not by me, but by some other, by the person or persons issuing the invitation. In a sense, the invitation deprives me of my freedom, or attempts to do so. Invitations always imply restraints and restrictions. Come for lunch, but not for breakfast. Stay for the weekend, not forever. Giorgio Agamben, the Italian philosopher and political theorist, explores ideas of sovereignty and self-determination in a number of his books. According to Agamben's troubling and provocative thesis, we are all now living in a state of abandonment, a state of exception, in which the rule of law has been effectively suspended by the sovereign or the state. The invitation may in fact form a part of this sinister state of exception, since all invitations work on the basis of what Agamben calls inclusive exclusion. Many are called, few are chosen. An invitation is a form of endorsement. It is also an effective form of separation. The philosopher who has most thoroughly explored ideas of invitation, though like Agamben, he does not address the subject directly and explicitly, any more than he addresses any other subject directly and explicitly, is Jacques Derrida. In one book in particular, Adieu à Emmanuel Levinas, Derrida engages with what he calls the subject of the welcome. According to Derrida, Levinas's great work, Totality and Infinity, might be read as a treatise on hospitality. He claims, indeed, that Levinas's entire thought is and wants to be a teaching on what to welcome and to receive should mean. But these are subjects perhaps so large and so difficult that anyone who is not a French philosopher can barely even begin to glimpse their meaning and design. Neither French nor a philosopher, let me retreat finally to theology. In Christian thought, the structure of revelation is a relationship initiated by God. It's basically an invitation-response structure. People have to hear the invitation. They can turn it down, but it must be heard. Respondez, s'il vous plaît. This is the impulse for evangelism and the justification for the role of the church. God, infinitely perfect and blessed in himself, in a plan of sheer goodness, freely created man to make him share in his own blessed life. So begins the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Come unto me, all ye that labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Matthew 11, verse 28. And the Spirit and the Bride say, Come. And let him that heareth say, Come, and let him that is athirst come, and whosoever will, let him take the water of life freely. Revelation 22, verse 17. I heareth, I am athirst.
We're at St Paul's Cathedral, which is just at the top of Ludgate Hill, and it sits there like a Portland stone beacon at the top of the hill. we've come to have a look at Holman Hunt's painting, The Light of the World. So we've come into the north transept of the cathedral, and we've come to the Middlesex Chapel, and I'm amazed that it's much, much bigger than I thought it would be. It's enormous, larger than life size, or at least if it's not larger than life size, then Jesus was very, very big. And it's the thing itself, the painting, is in this enormous kind of cupboard, like an armoire. It's quite difficult in the light to see. If we just go up closely now, and if we come right up as close as we can, and the extraordinary thing, my goodness, so it's towering above us now. And what strikes you at eye level is the text at the bottom in this beautiful picture frame. The text, I think, is from Revelation 3:20, which kind of guides you to understand the painting. I think it was, I don't know if it was Holman Hunt himself or Charles Booth who commissioned it, described it as a something like a sermon in paint. And the guide to the sermon is at the bottom in this verse. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him and will sup with him and he with me. Now, I've only ever seen this painting in terrible reproductions in church vestries and vicarages and in the frontispiece of presentation Sunday school Bibles. But in the flesh, as it were, up close, you can see the door on the left-hand side where the Christ figure is kind of just, it looks as if he's just gently rapping on the door. But famously, there's no handle on the door on the outside. So the door can only be opened from the inside.
The poet Emily Dickinson wrote a poem in response to the image, which she sent to her sister-in-law, Susan. Just so Jesus raps. He doesn't weary, last at the knocker and first at the bell. Then on divinest tiptoe standing, might he but spy the lady's soul. When he retires, chilled or weary, it will be ample time for me, patient upon the steps. Until then, heart, I am knocking low at thee. When even Jesus wearies, in Dickinson's poem, the beloved keeps knocking at the door. And so does death. In Irish legend, a banshee wails when someone is about to die, a sound not dissimilar, perhaps, to some of John Coltrane's later atonal experiments. Death, in the popular imagination, of course, is often a figure clad in black, carrying a scythe and beckoning towards us with a bony, upraised finger. Alas, there is no opportunity to refuse that final invitation. So, did I go to the palace? Did I accept the invitation? A man can refuse the queen, but he cannot refuse death, and he cannot refuse his wife.
The invitation was written and presented by Ian Sanson. It was produced in Belfast by Martin O'Brien. Welcome back now to the Royal Albert Hall, tonight's first prom, which is being given by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by their greatly respected principal conductor, Charles Dutoit. We're going to hear them now enjoying themselves, playing a piece which must surely be on the top 10 list of most popular prom symphonies, Tchaikovsky's Fifth. Earlier, I asked Maestro Dutoit what it was about the piece that he loved.
I always adored music by Tchaikovsky. There are many reasons. When I was young, you see, I was very close to the music of Stravinsky and his ballet and the Diaghilev. Stravinsky adored Tchaikovsky. In my 20s, I was invited to the opera in Vienna to conduct Swan Lake with Nureyev and Margot Fonteyn. So I've always been very close to this music. The symphonies, of course, they have this, plus this very dramatic thing. Tchaikovsky was very depressed, you know, at the end of his life.
The Fifth, though, he wrote when his life was a little more settled. It feels more optimistic. It's not quite as depressed as the Sixth or the Fourth. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I mean, let's say, cannot be depressed all the time, you see. there were some moments with light and joy. One thing is that Tchaikovsky was a European in a way, although very Russian-rooted. Tchaikovsky was very much looking at the West. Look at these waltzes and everything he has done. A lot of music inspired by Schumann, by people of the 19th century. So I think Tchaikovsky is kind of a big father in Russia. I mean, everyone admires and adores his music, and so do we.
Charles Dutoit talking to me earlier. Well, it is a wonderful piece. It's in four movements, and the mood is established right at the start. There's a low clarinet and strings playing a theme that then reappears throughout. When Tchaikovsky wrote sketches of the piece, he noted introduction, complete submission before fate, and shall I cast myself into the embrace of faith? So that sets the tone. Then, the slow second movement is a love song, the third a very jaunty waltz, reminding us that Tchaikovsky's next work would be The Sleeping Beauty, and then there is an exultant finale with just a tinge of tragedy. It is Tchaikovsky after all. But now, coming to the stage, Charles Dutoit to conduct the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. tumultuous applause here in the Royal Albert Hall for that performance by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra of Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony, conducted by Charles Dutoit. The conductor and every orchestra on stage looked as if they thoroughly enjoyed that performance. Dutoit conducting with no score. Very dramatic performance on the podium. Getting, I think, a wonderful performance from his musicians. He's now bringing various members of the orchestra to their feet, singling out clarinets at the moment. The bassoonist. Principal oboe. Now the flautist. I suspect this could go on. The entire brass section now on its feet. Dutoit has been the artistic director and principal conductor of this orchestra since 2009. He's bringing them all to their feet now. It's a wonderful reception here in the hall. I know this is a popular piece, but my goodness, you can't fail to enjoy it, can you? Wonderful performance. Well, as the applause continues to ring out around the Royal Albert Hall, that is it from this first prom of the evening. I do hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have here. Don't forget, you can listen again via the Radio 3 website. But as Charles Dutoit comes back to the stage to take another bow, it is time for me to hand you back to Broadcasting House and Jonathan Swain.
Katie, thank you very much. Katie Derham there at the Royal Albert Hall. And ways of hearing that prom again include, as Katie was saying, the iPlayer online for the next 7 days. There'll also be a chance to hear that prom broadcast again here on Radio 3 a fortnight from now at 2 p.m. Well, in just over 10 minutes this evening, the Lebrecht interview. Norman Lebrecht talking tonight to the opera director, Graham Vick. That's at 9:30. And after it, we're back live at the hall for our next prom, the London Sinfonietta in Six Classics of Post-War Music, Berio's Sequenza for solo trombone, Tsenakis' Phlegra, Jonathan Harvey's haunting electronic mix of bell and treble voice, Mortuus Plango Vivus Voco, Louis Andriessen's minimalist musical clock, De Snelheit, and the final build item is John Cage's infamous 4:33 of pure silence, that late-night prom. Is live here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, at 10:15. And it starts with Ligeti's Poème Symphonique with its 100 ticking metronomes. For the moment, back to Tchaikovsky. Did he cast himself into the embrace of faith in his Fifth Symphony? Russian church music is never that far away in his later symphonies. These are sections from Tchaikovsky's Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, music he began work on after he finished his Fourth Symphony in 1878, this selection including the cherubic hymn, the Creed, and opening here with O Come, Let Us Worship. The singers are the Leningrad Glinka Choir, conducted by Vladislav Chernoshenko. the Leningrad Glinka Choir, conducted by Vladislav Chernushenko, in music from Tchaikovsky's Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, ending there with the Creed. This is BBC Radio 3, it's 9:30, and throughout the prom season we've been featuring the Lebrecht interview, in which the writer and broadcaster Norman Lebrecht speaks to leading figures in the musical world, and here he is now to introduce this week's edition.
Graham Vick is an international opera director whose base for the past 25 years has been glamour-free Birmingham. Often provocative, sometimes inflammatory, Vick has staged works in many of the world's great houses and was for 6 years director of production at Glyndebourne. He's not a man who scares lightly. His recent Boris Godunov in St. Petersburg featured scenes of crowd protest against the Putin regime. A production of Rossini's Mosè Negito in Pesaro provoked international uproar for presenting the Hebrew slaves as Palestinians and the Egyptians as gun-toting Israelis. Born in Merseyside in 1953, Graham Vick directed Holst's Little Scene Savitri for Scottish Opera when he was only 24. He founded the Birmingham Opera Company in 1987 and remains its artistic director. When Covent Garden shut down in the late 90s, it was to Vick that they turned to reopen the house with a memorable Verdi Falstaff. His best work, he maintains, is done in Birmingham. An avowed socialist, Graham Vick likes to take opera to the people. For the Olympic Games, he's producing the world premiere of a helicopter opera, Stockhausen's Mittwoch, from the Licht cycle. We meet in Birmingham, in a disused factory, where he's in the thick of rehearsals. Graham Vick, it sounds like every boy's own fantasy, getting to play with big whirly birds, but it's probably a nightmare.
Nightmare, definitely not. Stressful, certainly. It's a very big project. But the helicopters, although they're fascinating, are only one small element of a big, fascinating sound world and an extraordinary concept of what music is. Stockhausen had an incredibly broad vision of music, of the theatre, and an extraordinary appetite and enthusiasm for creativity. And it seems a very natural fit here in the big laboratory that works, that the Birmingham Opera Company is. It seems it was made to be done here.
And apart from helicopters and players flying up in them and big screens, you're going to make the audience work. You're going to move them from one place to another. You're going to make them lie on their backs.
Well, the audience here always has to do some work. Theatre is about engagement, is about dialogue. And if you want a good experience, you have to contribute and not just sit back and judge. That's the basic principle. Right. And here, all the work I've done here has been about breaking down the barrier between performer and audience. An opening up the work as a shared experience from the inside. Stockhausen's sound world is multi-dimensional. And although the first few pieces of the Licht cycle were done in traditional opera houses, actually the vision...
Was it Donnerstag that was done at Covent Garden?
Donnerstag was done at Covent Garden,
and
that's
then one
right.
was at La Scala.
One was at La Scala, and in fact originally I should have done Freitag at La Scala, and so spent some time working on that with Stockhausen.
What happened?
And then La Scala ran out of money for that and didn't do it. It went to Leipzig. But I did spend 5 days with him working in his home in Germany.
And how was that?
Awe-inspiring. I mean, the man was the most articulate, fascinating, dazzling creature I had ever met. So I felt rather inadequate, is the truth. But at the same time, it was a matter of just trying to enter into where his mind was dancing all of the time, this extraordinary mercurial spirit, so kind of throbbing with creativity and ideas, and trying to just constant take on and think, what kind of theatrical world can I find?
And even I mean, the ideas are becoming by this time beyond impractical.
Practical is nowhere near the idea.
How does that relationship work then with somebody who refuses to be practical and somebody whose job it is to be practical? How do you communicate with somebody like Stockhausen on a human level, however?
Intuitively. It's about channeling thought, feeling. So much of this work is about receptivity.
It's also something very, very close to megalomania, isn't it? Were you not aware, are you not aware when dealing with this, of that perception of it?
Of course I'm aware of the megalomania. I'm a director. We are megalomania. I mean, we share it, no? I mean, the tension between overweening ambition and arrogance and utter humility before the awesome, before the divine, before whatever, is the tension that I face every day of my life. That's completely how my life works. That is absolutely, I'm afraid, that's right, I am that arrogant. But also, every day I feel I have to earn the right to do what I do. And the incredible privilege that I've been given to speak in the way that I'm able to speak. I mean, it's a fantastic gift, privilege, responsibility. And some of it is a great achievement for which I'm really grateful to a bit of myself. The problem is reminding that it's okay to have done well. I'm very British. I'm sometimes embarrassed at my, and it's never ever what I mean it to be. Actually, it's never quite good enough.
Right. You grew up in Liverpool. That's quite a
driven, grew up on Merseyside.
That's quite a driven place.
Grew up on Merseyside at a great moment, you know, when the football teams
right.
were winning every European championship, when the Beatles ruled the world, when we were the centre of the universe.
You remember the first Beatles number one?
Of course, the Beatles. My brother was a rock guitarist.
In the Swinging Blue Jeans.
In the Swinging Blue Jeans, Norman. That's correct.
Yes.
And I was surrounded by popular and rock music as a child.
And you weren't tempted? A little hippie, hippie shake?
Well, I loved it. I mean, I still do. You know, I've loved popular music. It's not either or, is it? It's all the same thing.
Was this attraction to opera, which was very young, you were about 12, was that a kind of a countercultural thing for you?
Look, it was all around 12, 13, and it was a part of a moment when I fell in love with Italy, Italian art, the Renaissance. I fell in love with opera, the theatre I'd been mad about since I was five.
Right.
That started up very early. Mm-hmm. So the theatre I was completely crazy about from a very early age.
Your parents took you?
My parents took me to Peter Pan, which was the utter epiphany, life-changing experience.
What, precisely?
Well, that's a big question, okay? I mean, now I think it was exactly the perfect piece for a boy who spent his life exploring father-son relationships. When I now look back over my work, I see a profound, complex father-son relationship. And I see it worked out in all sorts of ways, and I see it as being a big part of all kinds of creativity. But I also see it's a prism I've chosen to see things through unconsciously. So I think part of the reason I responded in such a big way was because of Mr. Darling and Peter Pan. But the other thing was The Flying Out Through the Window, which I completely recognised as who I was. That was Neverland. Life is not just the walls that we live in. That there is a bigger fantasy space. And here we're talking already about the world of Stockhausen. There is another place. There is a world inside us where we also live. That we're not just the person we are in relation to our friends and family. That there's a whole internal world where you can be somebody else, where other things can be released, where you can fly, where you can soar, where you can sail, where you can go other places, within the safety and security of that. I needed it, I wanted it, and I grabbed hold of it very strongly.
Your father had a clothing store, worked in a clothing store?
Worked for a clothing store, yes.
And your mother worked in a factory?
My mother, when I was very little, my mother didn't work at all. Then the minute I started school, she started a part-time job. She is a very strong, independent woman, not the kind of person to stay at home. Later on in life, she became worked in personnel in a factory and did rather splendidly quite late in her life, and in many ways found herself, I think. She's a very independent, strong woman.
So the escape mechanism that you found in theatre, what was that from? Was that from a humdrum background, did you think? Or
no, I think escape's the wrong word, Norman, isn't it? Escape's the wrong word.
Well, you're going through the window to Never Never Land.
Yeah, but it's not that there's anything wrong with where I am. That's what it is. It's just limited. It's the limitlessness of where I'm going. It's the window of possibility that I'm going to. It's not a rejection of where I am. It's the desire for more. No? It's also Icarus, isn't it? It's,
yep.
You know, frankly. It's also, okay. You know, it's the flying, but also sailing goes to the sun. It's the risk. It's the daring yourself to see how far you can go. It's all of that. But it wasn't a rejection of the humdrum. I had a wonderful childhood, you know, a wonderful time. My parents were fantastic parents.
Did they understand this in you? Did they understand your other life?
I had a fantastic upbringing because they gave me enormous independence and they allowed me to go where I needed.
Mm.
They didn't, I think, always understand, but they were always there one step behind, supporting and following, being interested. Obviously, I used to spend all my pocket money going to operas. And
where were you going as a kid?
I'm going to Liverpool.
Yeah.
No, we had we used to have Sadler's Wells that did, you know, five operas at a time.
They came up on tour, yes.
But five operas you could go to. Glyndebourne Touring Opera began when I was 13. That was five operas in a week, I remember. But also there was the Liverpool Grand Opera Society doing La Gioconda. What else? English Opera Group. I remember Janet Baker in The Rape of Lucretia. All this when I was 13, 14. I mean, it was rich. Welsh National Opera in Liverpool. At that point, you know, with the Liverpool Philharmonic.
You were going to be a conductor, weren't you?
Well, yes.
You went to the Royal Northern
my
College. When they said, what do you want to be? You said a conductor.
My life plan was to be a conductor. It's absolutely right.
Are there times, Graham, when you want to get in the pit and take over the conducting because the conductor, whoever he or she may be, is not hearing the piece in the way that you are in the inner ear, not just as a matter of pacing it, but of phrasing it, of expressing it, that you would be both director and conductor in the way that Carry On was?
I never have or would seek to be director and conductor any more than as a director I've ever sought to be a director and a designer. There's a limit, I think. There's a limit even to what I think I can do. Of course, there have been times when I've been disappointed in the musical aspect of the work I've been doing. But it's something I'm very, very careful of. I sometimes turn jobs down because of who's conducting. I'm very careful to go into situations which will give me an interesting and musically challenging experience. So I'm wary. I'm obviously wary. What I love doing is finding my way into a great conductor's world. That's fascinating. I love that. I don't need to control the music. I just want it to be good. No?
Mm.
I don't have to do it. It's like anything in one's work. It doesn't matter whose idea it was or where it comes from. We just want to do good work. And a lot of that is about trust, is about intuition, is about allowing yourself to enter somebody else's inner vision. It's not just about my. I don't have a specific. It's about receptivity.
No, but that's fantastic. When that isn't there,
I get stuck. That is absolutely
and
right.
And how do you deal with that frustration?
Well, I can lead the singers so far. I can lead the chorus so far, but I can't make a good Rigoletto.
Mm.
I can take it so far. But as we all know, when the performance happens, the man in charge is the conductor. There cannot be a great performance of an opera without a great performance by the conductor. No matter how many months of careful preparation and wonderful acting, if the conducting doesn't live, you've wasted your time.
And when it does work, you've had those kindred spirit moments?
with someone?
Oh, I've had some wonderful, wonderful experiences. With Gergiev, obviously, but with Muti, with Bernard Haitink, an extraordinary experience of doing Meistersinger. And these are experiences that aren't based on conversation. Frankly, these are not conductors who come to my rehearsals.
Yeah.
But they have complete, powerful, intuitive personalities. And to find your way into that and to learn to breathe with it, to find a world that goes in synthesis with that, is very exciting, because when it is together, and that's what you're trying to do, you're trying to find their world, when you do, it's fantastic. I mean, it's deeply, deeply thrilling.
You were 24 when you put on your first professional opera.
That's right. 24.
That was some presumption.
It was an act of enormous trust by David Pountney, I must say, to which I owe him an enormous amount.
How did it happen?
I'd been around since I was quite young as a Bright assistant. David asked me to go to... This is slightly embarrassing, actually. But David asked me to go to Scottish Opera to join the staff. And I was 23, and I rather grandly said, well, you know, I don't really want to just have a job as an assistant. I need to do, you know, I need to know I'll get a chance to direct. This was 23. Now I'm appalled when I remember, you know. However, I did say that. But, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained, no? And at that point, he said, look, I can't promise, but you're very talented. I'm going to do my best for you. And he said, however, we have a manpower jobs creation scheme grant to start a small company, and you can do that. You can lead that company. So that was a piano, five singers, and a stage manager, and me, which was a fantastic gift at 23, no? To do operas with piano accompaniment, to do schools work, and indeed I did shows for factories that we took around canteens at lunchtime. So I took the job, started this, loved it. I mean, it was completely where I was meant to be. A Glasgow factory canteen was my perfect audience. You know, I knew it. I'd been in canteens on Merseyside for several years. These were people I knew. It was a world I was comfortable with. I knew how to joke with the women. It was great. So that went very well, and David should have done this savagely.
What's the feedback that you were getting from women in headscarves?
Great, of course. It was great and raunchy and terrific. You know, we were doing more and more of it. I loved it. David should have done this production of Savitri, and for various reasons didn't, and gave it to me. And so I will always remember standing, looking at my wardrobe, wondering what shirt to wear on the first day of rehearsals, because I was going to go to my first ever rehearsal of a professional production, and it was going to be with Janet Baker. And it was very, very, very frightening. I remember deciding to wear my blue-grey corduroy suit, and I remember, but on that it was too smart, so I remember choosing a kind of friendly jumper that I put on underneath it that made it a bit more informal. I'm worrying away for about an hour, staring out of the window. I remember walking to work feeling ill, but from the minute I started speaking to her, I remember just knowing this was fine. She, of course, was open, humble, generous beyond belief. It was her Philip Langridge and John Shirley Quirk. None of them made me feel 24. None of them. They were all so open, not even generous because that sounds condescending. No, just normal, just so straightforward, and waited for me and gave me space. And I took it. I was fine. I was relaxed. Open, they were trusting, and we had a beautiful time. It's a wonderful experience. And that was great. I mean, you know, indescribably beautiful moment. What a way to begin.
At 30, they make you director of productions at Scottish Opera.
Yes, that was a lively time.
meaning pretty awful.
It was very tough to begin with. By the end, it was fine, but I'd already moving on. Yes, it was a very hard time, I think.